I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more remarkable books is Sound, a memoir of hearing lost and found. Its author, Bella Bathurst, joins me now. At the age of 27, she began to go deaf. She'd suffered two separate injuries from accidents, and soon she was losing her hearing. For 12 years thereafter, being deaf shaped her life until everything changed again. The book is marvelous in how she takes us through her hearing loss, how she is forced to confront it, and how she deals with it. She illustrates in a very sensory way just how much is lost in daily experience when hearing is diminished or gone. Ms. Bathurst also interviews factory workers, soldiers, musicians, as well as others whose work may have a detrimental effect on hearing. Bella Bathurst is a writer, photojournalist, and furniture maker. She has written four previous books of nonfiction, including The Lighthouse Stevensons, which won the Somerset Maugham Award. Her novel, Special, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction. Her writing has appeared in The Guardian and The Observer, among many other publications. This new book is published by Greystone Books. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Bella Bathurst. Ms. Bathurst, good morning.
Good morning.
Or good evening, I guess, in where you are tonight.
It is. It's dark already.
As I was telling you before we started, about how much I enjoyed the book. It's a beautiful book in that it reminds a lot of us about just how important our senses are. And for you, this has been such a remarkable experience. When was it that you first noticed that your hearing was diminishing? Was that after the two accidents you had?
Yeah, I had a couple of head injuries during my 20s. Not close together. There was 7 years distance between the two. But after the second one, I started going deaf fairly rapidly. Enough that I couldn't really ignore the problem. So I went off to the audiologist at the local NHS hospital, St. Mary's in London, and they tested me and they said, yeah, you're down about 50% in both ears. And they fitted me up with a pair of, as they then were, analog hearing aids. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much it. I later transferred to digital hearing aids, but that was pretty much it in terms of sort of actual kind of remedy, so to speak, at that stage.
So they told you then and there that the hearing loss was going to be ongoing and permanent. Is that right?
Well, sometimes I guess when you see doctors, there are questions that you just don't ask. I mean, I guess I took it as read, and I didn't want it restated that there were no hearing conditions which were curable. I'd certainly never heard of any at that stage, and the only people who I knew who were losing their hearing were old people. And apart from hearing aids, which are remedies, there was no cure as far as I was aware. So it was kind of a question that I just didn't ask because I didn't really want the answer, to be honest.
Yeah. So how did it? How do you notice these things? Because, as I said, you're a relatively young person at the time, and what compels you to go see someone? I mean, did someone tell you, hey, you're not listening to me?
My boyfriend kept saying that I wasn't laughing at his jokes, but I complained that I'd heard his jokes before. So, but he had a point. And actually, more than that, at that stage, I was writing, so I was 27, 28, and I was writing my first book, which was about the Scottish lighthouses, which were all built by the family of Robert Louis Stevenson. And I was lucky enough to be able to interview a lot of the last generation of lighthouse keepers. So I was going around the coast of Scotland talking to a few of these guys. And I realized when I got back home and started to transcribe the tapes of the interviews that, and obviously I could play the tape back at whatever volume I liked, that it was very evident that I kept missing beats, I kept missing connections, that they would say something and I would either mishear and get the wrong connection or just not hear at all, or I'd blank an aside or kind of miss a joke or kind of whatever it was. And I really didn't like that because it stopped being a conversation. It stopped being any kind of, you know, sort of two-way between two human beings. It was just a series of kind of, you know, misconnections kind of thing. And it made me feel like I was being very sort of unprofessional. So it was really that, more than anything, that made me go and get my hearing tested. And also, it was not something I could avoid because the loss was fairly rapid and fairly noticeable. So at that stage, I lived near a railway station, and you know, one week I'd be able to hear the station announcements, mm-hmm. and the next week I could hear a sort of fuzzy noise, and the week after that I couldn't hear anything at all.
What is this experience, this early experience that you have, teach you about sort of the denial that a lot of people go through, and not just hearing loss, but illness in general, or handicap in general?
Well, I guess you don't want to admit, I mean, you don't really, nobody wants to admit that there's a problem. And I guess particularly with sort of hearing loss, because at that stage, as I say, I was in my 20s, and my understanding of hearing loss and deafness was that it was an old person thing. And so, rightly or wrongly, I associated hearing loss with being stupid and being old. Stupid as in, you know, kind of a beat behind or several beats behind or kind of back 5 minutes ago from the punchline and just unable to really participate in the conversation and always needing a kind of helping hand for a catch-up kind of thing. And because I was in the media and a lot of my friends were in the media and that was the sort of world that we were in, we relied a lot on sort of wordplay and jokes and inferences and language and connection and sort of almost by definition communication. And suddenly I was finding myself kind of sort of more and more excluded from that. And I found that really, really difficult to deal with. So I guess the denial was, it was partly a denial to do with kind of infirmity, you know, there's nothing wrong,
yeah.
And partly a denial to do with the connotations that I saw came from deafness, whether they were wrong or right.
The book is really instructive in terms of, I guess, getting the reader to realize how they treat people with disabilities.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that I learned was that it's not up to the people that you meet to make things better for you. It's for you to make it clear what's going on and what you need. It would have been way easier if I'd said to people, look, I can't hear very well, so it really, really helps if you speak clearly, keep your face towards me and don't cover your mouth.
Uh-huh.
But I just didn't do that. I mean, I've always worn my hair long, so I wore my hair over my hearing aids so nobody could see them, and I tried to just bluff my way through. So apart from the friends who knew and my family, there was no reason why anyone would know, which was that much more difficult both for me and for them, because they couldn't work out why I would occasionally blank them.
Mm.
And I found myself kind of working three times harder than I actually needed to.
Yeah, I guess another instructive thing is knowing when to ask for help. I guess a lot of us whether it's pride or any so something else. If we do ask for help, we'll get it, won't we?
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess it's part of the thing with hearing loss is about you know, where exactly do you pitch it? I mean, because I couldn't work out sort of, you know, whether this is a really serious problem or a kind of or a joke, which is what a lot of people treated it as. So to say, look, I'm really kind of struggling here, and this is having much more of an impact than I thought it would, but everybody thinks it's funny, is really difficult. And so, yeah, I guess it took me a long time to ask for help.
The book is awfully sensory, and that's your gift as a writer, I think, because we get a sense of the various senses that you use, whether it's describing certain events in your life and the sort. When one loses one sense, in your case it was hearing, do the other ones, the other four, say, do they get heightened?
I think definitely. I think there's all, I mean, obviously the obvious one is sight, and I definitely learned sort of almost by accident to improve my vision. I went sort of purely coincidentally to go and work for a pro photographic lab, and I was just on the very, I mean, this is at the sort of point of a transition between film and digital, so they still had sort of quite a big film side. Uh-huh. So I was kind of sleeving negs and contacting film and that sort of thing. And if you are standing by a printer, you know, just looking at pictures day in, day out, it is a really, really, really brilliant visual education, because you're just seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly the whole time. So you really train your looking, and that definitely helped my vision to pick up some of the stuff that my hearing no longer could. But there was also a kind of really weird thing where I think when I was deaf, I kept getting this kind of weird stuff, like kind of like phantom smells. Mm. You know, I'd come downstairs and smell a stew cooking, or patchouli oil, and or the smell of heather, or it was just kind of it was and but really strongly, and really, you know, there were smells that couldn't possibly be there, but I would smell them all the same. It was very strange. It was almost like it was my brain going sort of testing. Okay, that synapse doesn't work, so let's try this one, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's another thing that struck me as I was reading the book, some ear surgery, for example, really is brain surgery, because if you do an X-ray or a scan of how the ear works and how it receives sound, whatever resulting image is taken, you can't see certain things, right?
Absolutely. It's just impossible. I mean, the ear, the mechanism of the ear is tucked so tidily and carefully inside the skull that it's impossible to see. So actually most of otology is detective work, because what you're doing is diagnosing according to the available clues. You can't, as you say, scan or and there's very little that you can see. All you can do is kind of plot a graph of the loss and surmise from that. So and I was lucky enough to, again, completely coincidentally come across this ENT surgeon who had not only done a huge number of operations, but has also sort of pioneered various different devices and prosthetics for ear surgery. And he was on a leg, there's a margin of error. I mean, you can, if the drill slips, then, you know, by a millimetre, it's not going to be the end of the world if you're drilling into a femur.
Uh-huh.
If your drill slips when you're operating on your, one of the bones of the inner or middle ear, then you risk paralysing the face or kind of irreversible brain damage or kind of God knows what. I mean, it is such high stakes stuff. He said he even times his breath to make sure that he's inhaling, not exhaling, as he uses the laser in a certain way.
I guess the other thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book is, a lot of us complained about the hustle and bustle of life, living in the city, say, and just wanting to get away from that sometimes. And one would think that being able to turn that off, as you were when you were using hearing aids, would be, say, I guess, useful at times. But it's so evocative in the book when you describe how disconcerting it is not to hear, that one realizes just how much we take for granted our hearing. And when you talk about how lonely it is, not only for yourself, but the people that you interview in the course of writing this book about people who've lost their hearing, I mean, it is a very lonely life, isn't it?
I think so. I came across, I mean, one of the things that I said in the book is that sight gives you the world, but hearing gives you other people.
Mm.
You know, which would you choose? Nobody wants to make that choice at all. But other people are kind of important. And, I certainly spoke to a lot of people who had their hearing damaged in the course of work. Or through music, and certainly in the armed forces there was a real issue with it because hearing protection and the armed forces, you know, it's a tricky issue because sometimes wearing hearing protection means that you can't hear, you know, either an instruction or what's happening behind you or kind of stuff that you really, really need to be able to hear when you're on the battlefield. And there were a lot of people who had covered it up simply because they'd got to a certain point in their careers, discovered that they were losing their hearing, and it would have meant instant demotion if they had reported it. So, and there was collusion on both sides, because the top brass didn't want to demote them any more than they wanted to be demoted, because they just paid all that money to get them trained.
Yeah.
So, and they also didn't want to pay compensation. So you got all these guys, mainly men, obviously, because they suddenly find themselves on the wrong side of 40 or 50, is discharged from the armed forces, and, you know, having never admitted to this, and coming from a sort of a professional culture which, where you were showing vulnerability or asking for help, is sort of trained out of you, and really lonely. Yeah, really lonely. And, you know, there would be a lot of sort of black humour and jokes and that sort of thing, but you could really hear the sadness and the loneliness behind that.
And that's the other thing that I got out of the book, was that whether you work, say, in music or in the military, as you just said, or even just aging, we tend to take hearing loss as a natural progression of age. It doesn't have to be, or in the case of certain work, an occupational hazard. It doesn't have to be. And there are certain legal remedies now, aren't there?
Certainly with industry. I mean, industry has really cleaned up its act. I mean, it was fascinating looking at some of the records and listening to some of the reports from the Glasgow shipyards when they were at sort of full strength during the kind of, you know, 1900s to 1960s. And, you know, they were big, big spaces with kind of loads of metal, thousands of people working there, all riveting and banging and pouring steel and you know, constructing ships at a rate of knots. And the level of noise, there was no hearing protection there. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a Glasgow doctor who discovered that 100% of shipyard workers could not hear the speaker at a public meeting. They had all some fairly profound level of hearing damage just from industrial noise. That's now been virtually eliminated by, certainly in the UK, by the Noises at Work Act. So industry is pretty good, but the army and music are both still very... I mean, it's a really difficult one. I mean, there's been a court case in the UK quite recently from one of the big orchestras who was sued by a viola player who complained that his hearing had been irreversibly damaged because violas are always put next to the brass section.
Mm.
And the orchestra argued that some degree of hearing loss was, you know, just came with the job. And that was found to no longer be a valid defence, I think. So the viola player won, and that was a real breakthrough. So I think the music industry may have to start sort of cleaning up its act as well. But it's a really difficult one because people, you know, there are some forms of music that just aren't designed to be heard quiet.
Yeah, yeah. The there's so much in the book, I could talk to you all day about it. I'm going to unfortunately have to skip the part of the book where your hearing is restored. There's so many aspects in there that it would take up. I urge people to pick up the book because it's worth reading for that itself. Your hearing was restored, and it's beautiful in the book when you talk about just the value of the everyday and the mundane and what that was like to rediscover again upon getting your hearing back.
Yeah, well, having always been a nosy git, I have always been a passionate eavesdropper. So I've always really, really enjoyed sitting on the top deck of buses and listening to people talking and, you know, sitting in cafes or walking down the street or kind of whatever it is or kind of at the next door table. And that was just... I remember listening sort of after the second operation. I was just sitting in a cafe listening to a couple of people from a nearby office bitching about their colleagues. And it was just like, I so nearly kind of leant over and went, thank you. It was such a joy to listen to this conversation. It was so brilliant.
There's a moment in the book near the end that is just beautiful where you are watching television and you're... going up and down on the volume on the remote.
It's like I can play with this as much as I like.
Yeah.
I can make it really quiet. I can make it really loud. And I do occasionally silence the volume on the TV just to see if I'm still kind of okay at a bit of lip reading. I think I'm losing my touch a bit, but I used to be quite good.
So as you get older, as you'll get older, you will naturally, I guess, you will lose more hearing, as we all will. Having gone through it once, I mean, will it be easier, say?
I guess so. I am better informed, better defended against the possible consequences of it, and one of the interesting things that I found out when I was researching the book is that certainly in the UK anyway, it takes people an average of 10 years before they go for a hearing test.
Mm.
Because people just don't want to acknowledge that problem. I mean, people would never do that with their sight. I mean, you go off and get a pair of reading glasses, no problem. But people do because they see it as such a marker of age. they have an issue with going and getting their hearing tested. I hope and I trust that because I know what I do, and I also know that the remedies, the hearing aids, are very, very good, it wouldn't take me that long.
Now, are there things that we can do to, say, improve our hearing in the course of writing this book? Are there things that we should or shouldn't do in terms of how we go about our life so that our hearing is, to say, a little more protected, maybe?
Yeah, just don't stand close to the speaker at festivals, and don't work in a shipyard without ear defenders, and possibly don't join the armed forces.
Yeah.
I also make furniture, and I'm pretty scrupulous about wearing ear defenders when I'm you know, sawing anything or using any of the machinery. But I do know a lot of joiners and woodworkers and people who are regularly using machinery who didn't grow up in an age when people were, you know, good at sort of putting on protective equipment, so they just don't, and they do have trouble with their hearing. So while you've got it, just savor it, and also just pay attention to it. I mean, one of the things that I've been doing is over the past kind of 6 months or so is just doing a tweet of the day, a sort of great sound of the day, and it could be something really daft, like a pencil being sharpened or an envelope being slit open, or someone biting into an apple or something. Just some small sound, or the sound of flip-flops. But it is, they're all lovely, and they're all sort of meaningful, and they're all sort of worth paying attention to.
Did any of the doctors you saw over the years, did they say anything about, I don't know if this is a something that happens where you're from, but in North America, certainly, you know, cotton swabs and using those in one's ear, that's frowned upon. I mean, have any of the medical folks that you've talked to, have they advised against that, say?
Yeah, you're never supposed to put earbuds down your ear. You just generally try and let it clear itself, but just go and check, get your ears checked out if you're worried about them for any reason.
Bella, as I said, it's such an instructive book. It's a helpful book, and in many parts a beautiful book. I so appreciate your time today, taking the time to talk to me about it, and congratulations on this book, and good luck with it.
Well, thank you so much.
Good night, Bella.
It's really kind of you. Good night.
The book is called Sound, A Memoir of Hearing Lost and Found. It's published by Greystone. Its author, Bella Bathurst, joined me on the line from Wales in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.